Also now joining us in studio, we have Mr. X, who was a passenger in a vehicle last Friday night. Ian on the phone. We welcome to meet the new press attorney, Mark Stevens. Welcome, sir.
Thank you.
And thanks for taking time out of your Saturday to join us today. Now, what we want to do, I wrote a story that appeared here on Granite Rock last weekend, and then I reprinted it in a slightly changed fashion in my newspaper column here in the Laconia Daily Sun about an incident that occurred at a DWI or sobriety checkpoint last Friday night in Auburn, New Hampshire. And what we've got is the passenger of the vehicle that I wrote about in the column and on the post with us. And welcome.
How's it going?
Okay.
Good morning, Mr. X.
Yes, Mr. X. Not that they did anything wrong, mind you, and I just want to say at the outset for the folks listening, don't misconstrue anything of what we're going to say is that we in any way condone drinking and driving. That's something that should never be done, and I don't think anybody would disagree with that. So with that, Mr. X, why don't you briefly, because the time flies by, what I'd like you to do is tell us what happened, and then I'd like to have Attorney Stevens perhaps, and feel free to cut in at any point if you've got a question, sir, but I'd like for him to tell us what he thinks about this. So, Mr. X, you're on.
All righty. It was last Friday night, and I was coming home from Canobie Lake Park with my friend. And we come to a sobriety checkpoint in Auburn, and when we pull up to the officer, she says, "Hi, this is a sobriety checkpoint, and we're just checking for drinking and driving. Have you been drinking?" And the driver said, "No, I have not." And she goes, "Well, have the passenger been drinking?" And I said, "No." She asked us to pull over to the side of the road, and then she asked us both to get out of the car. And
could I ask you a quick question there?
Absolutely.
Did she ask you how old you were before she asked you if you had been drinking?
No, she didn't.
Okay.
And let's tell, the driver was 19.
The driver is 19, and I am 21.
Yeah, and the relevance of that is that if the driver is not drinking and the passenger is of age, there's no drinking and not driving is not a crime, at least yet. And so that doesn't establish any sort of probable cause or reasonable suspicion that there was a crime afoot.
Now, and as a parent of a teenager, I would just interject in here, too, that one of the things that we're aware of is that, like, if our teenager is out with people that are of age and the teenager is driving the vehicle, there can be absolutely no alcohol in that vehicle at any time.
That's correct, because then they can be arrested.
Correct. So, okay, Mr. X, continue.
All right. And so they asked us to step out of the car, and they took the driver to the back of the vehicle, and they put me to the front of the vehicle. They talked to the driver first, and they made her do a little sobriety test. They asked her to touch a pen, and she did that. And they asked her also to follow it back and forth, and she did that just fine. Then they asked her if could she search the car. And she said yes, with nothing to hide, and they searched the car. After the first time searching the car, they came right up to me at the front of the car, and they asked me, have I been drinking? And I said no. And they had me do another sobriety test by touching the pen and following the pen back and forth. And then she also asked me, have you been drinking tonight? And I also said no again. And she went back to the car and searched it one last time.
Now, didn't the cop keep saying something to you guys as well while this was going on? Didn't they keep asking you something or saying?
Yes, they asked me, and they kept saying, if you can just tell us what it is and where it is, this could go a lot faster. And the driver, with a little attitude, said, there's nothing in my car. I'll help you tear it apart. So go ahead. You can search my car. They came up to me, and they asked me for my ID. And when they asked me for my ID, they asked me to empty out my pockets. Also, with nothing to hide, I did so, and they looked at my ID for, like, quite a while and was making sure that it was me.
Mm-hmm.
I also was standing on the ground, and I moved dirt with my foot because I was standing on rocks, and a cop was right there to say, what are you trying to hide? And I said, nothing, I was just standing here.
Yeah, it sure sounds suspicious, yeah.
Yeah, and I then also put my hand on my stomach just to, like, I put my hand on my stomach, and then he said, once again, are you trying to wipe something off your shirt? And I said, no, I'm just standing here waiting. Then after that, the officer went back to the car and started searching it again. and then another officer came over to the back of the car and did the, another sobriety test to the driver again, which she passed again. And then he came right up to me and did it again to the front and asked me again, have I been drinking? And I said no. And he made me do the pen touch, and I had to touch the pen, and I followed the pen back and forth. And then he went back, and he searched the vehicle also with the other officer. Meanwhile, the car was running the whole time, and the driver asked the cop who was just standing in the back, could you ask the officer who's searching my car to shut off my ignition? He says, no, ma'am, your car is fine. This will only take a minute. After 10 minutes later, she asked again, can you please just shut off my ignition? And he says, well, if you tell us where what it is and where it is, this could go a lot quicker. She says, there's nothing in my car. I can help you tear it apart. There's compartments underneath my seat. My seat's fold down. And they still search the car.
So in, at the end of it all, how long were you guys at the side of the road?
I was outside of the car, standing on the side of the road for 25 minutes.
Wow.
Now, does this sound right to you at all, Mark?
No, it doesn't. There are several things wrong with this. The first is, there's no lawful basis to even ask the passenger to step out of the car based on the information that was available to the officer at the time that she did so. Can I ask him how many officers were there at the scene?
I counted about six.
Okay, because during a traffic stop, the federal constitution, current interpretation, is a case called Pennsylvania versus Mims, which allows an officer to conduct what they call an exit order for safety-based reasons. So if the officer felt that she was in danger, it sounds like it would be a reach to say that she was with six of them and two of you, and no evidence of any criminal activity. They could ask the driver to get out. And under another case called Maryland versus Wilson, they can ask a passenger to get out for the same reason, for a safety-based exit order. And that would allow them to pat frisk you to make sure you don't have a gun or anything dangerous on you. But it does not allow them to convert it into an inquisition like they did here. It's for the officer's safety once she determines that you're not any risk to her. They had no basis to ask you to do field sobriety tests. You don't have to be sober to be a passenger in a car. Whether you were impaired or not is irrelevant, frankly, to whether the driver should continue to be seized or whether you should continue to be seized.
Yeah, especially where the passenger, Mr. X, is of legal age. I mean,
right.
My thought is even if he was passed out drunk in the seat.
That was the example I was just going to use. If you were hunched over the seat and not to be too gross, but throwing up all over yourself, there's no reason to get you out of the car. And the other thing is the inquisition about tell us where it is, tell us where it is, and the search itself is illegal. If they don't have probable cause to search your car and there's no suspicion that arises during their encounter with you, that would cause them to believe that there is something in the car that's illegal, they had no right to search that car at all. And this is what one of the underlying concerns with roadblocks are, apart from the fact that they're just stopping people who have done nothing wrong, is that they convert them into a general criminal investigation. And that is where the Supreme Court of the United States has drawn the line. They did that in Indianapolis versus Edmonds, where they were searching cars for drugs. And they said, no, you can't turn a roadblock into just a generalized criminal sweep, if you will. That's my word for it. But you can't just stop the cars and see if anybody's doing anything wrong. They have allowed them to do specific DWI roadblocks, where they check for impairment. But it's supposed to work like this. You roll into it. If they smell alcohol, it goes further. Or if somebody's slurring or something like that, the investigation goes further, and if it doesn't, they're supposed to be led on their way. The Attorney General guidelines on this, by the way, the New Hampshire Attorney General guidelines, suggest to them that the detention should not be longer than a minute.
Now, Mark, what we're going to do is, if you wouldn't mind, we're going to hold over and take a break right now. Can you stay till the other side?
Sure.
Okay, because Mr. X has a comment or a question he'd like to throw in here, and then I have another question as well. So with that, ladies and gentlemen, this is Meet the New Press. We're going to take a break here and listen to our sponsors. When we come back on the other side, we're going to continue with Attorney Mark Stevens and a passenger who was in a vehicle at a sobriety checkpoint that just seems like the police certainly didn't follow the conventional routine one would find of these. So don't go anywhere. We'll be right back.
And we are Meet the New Press. I'm Chan Eddy. We are joined, of course, by Skip and Doug. And we're speaking with Mr. X, a passenger in a car that was stopped at a sobriety checkpoint. in Auburn, down near Manchester. And there was some controversy about this. One, the length of time that this sobriety check took place. We're also joined by attorney Mark Stevens. He's a well-known DWI attorney and has been listening in and asking a few questions and offering a bit of advice. And I know that Mr. X had a question for Mr. Stevens. So, Mr. X, go right ahead.
Okay. Also, when they asked us to search the car, knowing we had nothing to hide, if we were to say no, is that like probable cause to like actually search our vehicle still?
No. Denying consent by itself does not establish probable cause. They would have to be able to point to specific reasonable facts that were available to them at the time that they wanted to search. They did not see a crime committed in their presence, so they don't have any right to arrest anybody. That's how they get to a lot of searches, is they'll arrest them for something like a minor in possession or something like that, and then they can rifle through the car. But even if you had consented under those circumstances, and let's say, I know you didn't do anything wrong, but let's say they did find something illegal in the car, that evidence would probably be thrown out in court because the search would be illegal. The any consent that the police obtained after an illegal seizure, so, you know, they've got you out on the roadside, they're field sobriety testing you for no reason and all the rest of it, the seizure becomes illegal at a certain point. Then they get consent. That consent, under the New Hampshire case of State versus Height, would be unlawful or tainted consent, and it wouldn't count in court.
Now, why do you suppose they would do this? Do you think that this was simply because we're talking about two young people here?
Probably.
I mean, it's just when I heard the story.
Because what happens at these things, generally with roadblocks, they're very inefficient means of detecting drunk drivers. And they get very low yields. What I mean is, based on the number of people that are stopped and hassled, they're lucky to get one or two DWIs out of these things out of every 100 people that they stop. Whereas if you're dealing with roadside stops, people who are weaving, crossing yellow lines and things that drunks do, the yield is much, much higher. So they have to justify the funding that they get for these things by making some arrests. So if they're not getting DWIs, they want to be able to get, you know, possession of marijuana charges and minor in possession of alcohols and other less serious things, so that they can say, well, we didn't get any drunks, but look at all this other stuff we found.
Mark, this is Skip Murphy, and you're sitting here with two engineers in the studio, Chan and myself, and one of the things that we always have to worry about in our professions is what is the cost-benefit ratio, which seems to be very... let's throw that phrase under the bus as far as governmental work is concerned. And you bring out a very important point that I didn't know before, that the roadside stops are only a 1% yield. Are there any stats that are available for that? And is there a way to say, well, here's how much every stop is costing, even if it's a low level or not even a drunk driving stop? Well, we found this other stuff. Is there a way to say, is this something that we should continue as a policy or not because of the cost-benefit ratio?
Well, that's interesting. The one of the Supreme Court justices, Justice John Paul Stevens, in the leading case on this Michigan versus Sitz, wrote a dissent, and he said that he wrote something to the effect that not only did it cost a lot and it was not cost-effective, but it probably had a negative effect on detecting drunk drivers because you're tying up so many police officers in a roadblock that they're not out actually catching the actual drunks. So picture taking 12 to 16 officers, I don't know how many were working on this particular roadblock, and take them off the 28 bypass and just put them in a downtown area where the bars are letting out at 1 o'clock. And it's not easy to figure out that they're going to get more than one DWI because they're trained to look for certain things in a way that a driver is driving. Here what they do is they say, okay, for every 100 cars that rolls in, we just got to hope that one of them's drunk, because if we get a couple of drunks, we'll get more funding next year. And this money all flows from the federal government. I think there's a conception that federal money grows on trees, I guess, because it doesn't come out of a department's budget. But we're all paying for these things.
Okay, so basically what a lot of this came down to in this case, it looks like they were guilty of being young and sober.
And in the wrong place at the wrong time. The problem is that the number of wrong places is growing. These roadblocks are cropping up everywhere.
And where is this funding coming from? And I'm wondering if this is more the base of this. And, you know, none of us here want to keep drunk drivers on the road. So for those that are listening to us, this is not the point of it. But if there is a more efficient way, and again, two engineers here in the studio, if there's a more efficient way of spending the taxpayer money to accomplish the same thing, we'd be all for it. So, again, I come back to, is this a case where this is just, you know, low-hanging fruit for funding?
It is, and it's also they're a publicity stunt at their best. You know, it shows everybody taking a bite out of crime and taking DWI seriously, and nobody's saying that they shouldn't take DWI seriously. But this is just simply a horribly inefficient means of catching people. You know, you take that same number of people and the resources, and now they've even got these at one of the roadblocks. They've got one of these big Batmobiles where they have holding cells and breathalyzers and all the other stuff inside the vehicle. I think they cost close to $500,000. Take all that stuff and put it into extra patrols at certain times of night when most DWIs are arrested, and there's no way you wouldn't get a much, much, much higher arrest yield.
No.
In better cases, because think about the case when it goes to court, and there's an officer testifying about driver A who was driving over a yellow line into the oncoming lane of traffic. He almost hit a guardrail. He didn't slow down in time. He screeched his car to a stop. That sounds like erratic driving, and it is. And picture the testimony about a car rolling into a roadblock. The driver rolled up. He stopped on time. He rolled his window down on time. You know, it's a different case, and it's a better case. A roadblock case, frankly, is a better case for the defense in any case.
Now, you know, the thing that it's interesting that this happened to Mr. X, in that they were able to get in contact with me, because where I work, we're a bunch of avid newspaper readers, and we've been reading about here in the Lakes Region vacation area these various sobriety checkpoints that they've been conducting throughout the region in the summer.
Yes.
In the lunchtime talk is, oh yeah, look at this DWI checkpoint. They got one drunk, seven faulty equipment, two possession, three people wanted for a bench warrant.
Yep. Someone's got a warrant because they didn't pay a speeding ticket. Sure.
Exactly. In the word, the term that you used, a sweep, is really in my mind exactly what this is. And
yes.
I just don't understand in a state that has so much trouble with real ID and with the Patriot Act and all that this, the residents would tolerate this sort of behavior, because I've got to believe that what happened to Mr. X and the driver is not, they can't be alone in this circumstance.
No, they're not, because one of the things that I get when I'm challenging a roadblock from the state, whatever police department it is that we're litigating with, is they have to give me the number of people that they stopped, and they keep logs of what happened to these people. In other words, they may, Mr. X, it would just show field sobriety tested and released in his case. But the numbers of people that are field tested and released are quite high. So when the police argue that, well, these are just a minimal intrusion, if you're not doing anything wrong, we just check your license, registration, and send you on your way, that's not the case. They're having people step out of their cars, and when you're asked to step out of your car, you don't know if you're ever going to get back into it, you know, follow the pen and stand on one leg and so forth. That is not a minimal intrusion to the average New Hampshire driver, is my guess.
Now, what do you think? I mean, I don't think, Mr. X, you can correct me if I'm wrong here. I mean, I don't think there's any intention to do anything about this, but what? But do you have a thought, Mr. X, before I get into my question of Mr.
Just one thing that is, like, when we asked, like, we were just polite and we respected, like, the officers, like, with the respect that we wanted to get, but it seemed like they treated us, like, different just because we were younger. And when I was out of the car and, like, they were questioning me, it felt like I was guilty before, like, proven innocent, not innocent before proven guilty. And I think it was also because of my age and, like, the driver I was with. And I don't think that was fair for, like, what is done to me just because, like, I was young. And this past experience has really, like, changed my opinion on, like, how cops are supposed to, like, serve and protect us.
Sure, so. That's understandable.
Now, and the thing is that what would, and again, I told you that we weren't going to be asking for free legal advice, but, I've got a neighbor that went through one of these, and his experience was different. He was telling me they rolled through it, They answered a couple of questions. They did produce license and registration, and they were offered a survey sheet, and they were on their way in a couple of minutes. But that seems very different than what occurred here. I mean, we're talking two people that lost 25 minutes of their life for no reason.
For no reason at all.
At a checkpoint. And so, I mean, what would you tell the listeners out there that their response should be if they're in this sort of a situation?
Well, the thing with it is that when when the listener finds him or herself awash in a sea of blue lights, and they're being demanded to do things, they're probably going to do them, because most people raised to respect and obey law enforcement are going to say, well, I'll go along with whatever they want me to do. I haven't done anything wrong. But there'll come a point where, like Mr. X, where he says, why should I have to do all this stuff? I didn't do anything wrong. Why are they yelling at me for kicking dirt in front of me because I'm nervous? Why are they asking to search my car when there's no evidence or smell of marijuana, there's no indicia of drug use or an illegal gun or anything else that would cause them to have to search it? It's a difficult situation to deal with, but once they stop you, the unfortunate thing, the might and power of the state is they can block roads now, and they can stop people, and they can hassle them, and they can basically do whatever they want as long as they've got a court order that says they can do it.
It's unbelievable.
The only recourse that we have is we challenge all of these very aggressively in court and challenge the legality of them. And the unfortunate thing is the only people that are challenging them are people who've been arrested. You know, the people that are let go are the ones that we don't hear from.
Exactly. And again, we're talking about two innocent people that basically lost 25 minutes of their life. And we live in a society that tells us, shut off your engine, conserve gas, you're addicted to oil, you bad person. And then here they are left on the side of the road with their car running for 25 minutes. Now, I have another question. When I was doing the research for the story and I went to your website, you had a blog post up there about videotaping.
Yes.
And, you know, we've just got maybe a minute or so left, but what's up with that? Because
that's been a pet peeve of mine for a long time, because if you watch the news, you see videotapes of DWI arrests from all over the country, and they're videotaped, and you can tell by looking at that person if they're drunk or not. It's very simple. But with all the money and all the king's horses and all the king's men that are put into New Hampshire roadblocks, none of them are videotaped.
And
why wouldn't they just put up a camera like they do? You know, you drive through, I just bought a cup of coffee. I drove through a drive-through line. There's a camera there.
Yeah, exactly.
A camera in your bank, a camera in the mall. Everywhere you go, there's video cameras. They're cheap. They're easy to operate. And it's a lot cheaper than having 16 officers and a bunch of cruisers out there. If you could just put that videotape up, things like what happened to Mr. X would not happen.
Now, first of all, it's my understanding that lots of cruisers have cameras anyway. And secondly, I've got one last question. I've been known around these parts with my little handy cam and my tripod. What do you think would happen if I got wind of a police roadblock and strolled on over there, got dropped off with my own video camera to videotape them? What do you think my chances would be of getting some tape? And should I bring another video person to videotape what happens to me?
Your own arrest. I don't think that they're going to warm up to that, because I don't think they want these things videotaped. Because the bottom line is they're stopping and seizing hundreds of people that are doing nothing wrong at all. It doesn't matter if they're polite about it. And I know most of them are. They say, good evening, this is a sobriety checkpoint, because sobriety checkpoint sounds better than roadblock, which is what it is.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't matter if they're polite about it. They're still stopping you. You don't want to deal with the police if you haven't done anything wrong, and you shouldn't have to. But a videotape would show that these things are an incredible waste of resources, a waste of time, and that some of the people that are getting arrested are just frankly not drunk.
Unbelievable in America to boot. Mr. X, any last word for Attorney Stevens?
No, not really, but I appreciate you actually coming on the show, and I thank you for answering a couple of my questions, though.
Okay, you're more than welcome.
Okay, and you got a blog site or a website to promote before we say goodbye?
I do. My website is byebyedwi.com.
Excellent.
And my blog is byebyedwi.blogspot.com.
Okay, and of course the folks can go to Granite Grok and look at the radio post and link over as well. And what we'll do is we'll give you a heads up, Mark, when the podcast is ready. and feel free to use it for whatever you'd like. I found this to be a very fascinating half hour, and I want to thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you for calling.
Okay, very good. And Mr. X, you did great. Maybe we'll have you in for your point of view, because I think that the 21-year-old member of society has a different take on life, Skip and Chan, than most likely we do, and I appreciate that as well. So thanks.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Okay, you did great.
Thank you.